Okay, 1, 2, 3, clap. Did you clap when I said clap? We'll try one more time. 1, 2.
Ah, now you're frozen.
You froze.
1, 2, 3,
clap.
Hey, I think that was together. And then it won't be together because of Zoom. For anyone, nobody knows the reference to this. This is from the last episode.
The last episode of The Grim Reader.
And we're not putting on a really posh British accent there. We mean lost instead of last. This is the last episode. That,
I just started watching Lost, but we'll get into that. we're recording this lastminute.com because Becca is amazing and is going to edit this up real quick to get it released on Friday. So you're listening to us and we're so sleepy on a Wednesday night because we recorded on Saturday and it was a really fun episode with two like really recent books as well. And the audio just is such a disaster. It's so bad. So we've sent it off to get fixed by people who are smarter than us. And hopefully that episode will be out soon. It was a really good episode.
But I'm just going to refer to it as the last episode of Atlantis from now on.
The last episode of Atlantis.
And yeah, it turned out that editing Becca could not edit.
And then editing Nikki stepped in and I kind of fixed it a little bit. It was a lot better, but it just wasn't. It's not up to standard, lads.
No, we were like, we're by the episode 40s now. Like, we can't release this shit anymore.
I was so proud of my Josh Tanner story.
I know.
I was even telling my mom about it.
I hated him. Sorry, we're like the references to last episode. Like, I know this character from her fictional story. I hated.
Yeah,
like,
my mom. By the way, my mom, when I was telling her about the episode that went missing, my mom was like, "This week was like, would Rebecca ever write? Her stories are always better than the books she recommends."
I wouldn't say that now, to be honest. Like,
you write the best story.
It's very different than if you're trying to attempt to write them.
Ah, but they're good though. They're
I do not have a command of the English language.
Girl, you know, there's been plenty of good books where the writing isn't the thing that draws you in, it's the plot. And you've got the plot, baby.
Thank you. Yes. But yeah, so that is our update on the podcast. It was...
This is why we are sleepy and a little bit cranky to be filming this last minute episode.
Talk about yourself, to be honest, because I think I'm doing quite well for the moment.
I'm so tired. Can I lift my spirits and tell everyone that, guys, I know it's 2021, but you need to start watching Lost. You have to do it. It's so good. It's amazing. And I mentioned it on the last episode because Stephen King is also a huge fan of Lost, which is why I was like, I'm going to finally start it because I love the film score. I listen to it all the time. I've gone to see the Lost concert like 3 times now.
The amount of times you have mentioned the Lost soundtrack and all this kind of stuff, I assumed you'd seen it.
Never. I'm obsessed with Michael Giacchino and I've seen that on concert 3 times now. And I've still never watched the show, but that's kind of why, because the music is so like that life and death piece is so sacred that I was like, if the TV show doesn't live up to this, I'll be angry on behalf of Mr. Giacchino. And especially when the show is so hyped as like one of the best shows of all time. I'm only in season one and I was already crying and laughing and going through the emotions. And I'm on episode 7. It's so good.
I think we should take a moment to actually congratulate Nikki for watching something that isn't Housewives.
Yeah. Thank you.
To be honest,
there's a new episode out tonight, so look, you'll hear about it.
This is like a big deal for us. I love how that's what you're watching, and then last night our TV, the connection to the TV went, so my mom was like, oh, we'll just connect it to the iPad and watch something there. So we started watching 9 Perfect Strangers, which is Amazon series, I think, but it's based on the Leanne Moriarty book. And this is Big Little Lies, which I didn't particularly enjoy from many, many, many episodes ago. But it's odd. Like, we're two episodes in and it's, I don't know. I'm there like, are they making people drink their own blood? Like, what the hell is going on? Like, cannibalism is coming into my mind.
Oh, no. We've gone so far without bringing that awful shit up.
It's odd. Like, it's... I'm really like... But in other news, to get us away from cannibalism, I am going lost.
Okay, and also this is actually more important than watching.
This is actually
go for it, Becca.
I am going to be abseiling down Thomond Park. Woo!
Woo!
So for any listeners that aren't in Ireland, Thomond Park is a big rugby stadium in Limerick, and I'm going to be fundraising for Down Syndrome Limerick, which is a cause very close to my heart. So on the 18th of September, people, please wish me luck and hope that I don't, like, the equipment doesn't break and I fall flat and die and splat onto this road. But
that's the start of a novel in itself.
Like, woo, abseiling.
Woo!
So I know fun.
It's going to go fab, Becca. But you will share the donation link on the Grim Reader Instagram. If you would like to make a donation before September 18th, if you listen to this episode on time, which, well done if you do, we love you.
Yes,
if you don't, I'm sure the charity are taking donations all year long.
Absolutely.
And just donate to a good cause. Take this as your, like, just do a good thing today. Yes, like Becca, go abseiling.
Let's say in a safe, controlled environment. Safe, controlled environment. But yeah, no, I will probably share it onto my Bookstagram.
Yes.
If you would like to support me and donate to a great cause.
We love supporting Becca.
We'll see. I mean, it's going to be interesting because I have a fear of heights. So, woo! Good luck to me.
Go donate, guys. Please. Go donate.
Nikki's going to turn up and just like... Here we go. Instagram live. Here's Becca.
Becca's abseiling, bitch. And I'll be like in a cheerleader outfit, like, go, Becca, go.
And you'll be like, go faster, Becca. Oh my God. What's wrong with you?
Make that money, honey.
But yeah, will we move on to books?
Yes.
So I'm going first. And I'm actually.
I think the reason you're doing this is because you didn't like my story in the last episode. I'm a little bit offended. when the infamous last episode of Atlantis comes out, you'll know.
You'll know, because we're going to title it The Last Episode of Atlantis. Like, no, there's no reference to it in the episode, but like, that's what it's going to be. And you'll know. But so why I'm not getting Nikki to guess this book is because actually it is based on the real life history of Cyprus and the conflict and war that went on in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt that would be disrespectful if we kind of came up with a kind of story, a jokey story about it. A lot of our stories aren't jokey.
Yeah. Oh no. And it's good to shine light.
So the book that I'm doing this week is The Island of Missing Trees by Elif Shafak. Now, this is one that I'm going to preface. I did get off NetGalley. I read it very recently. It is a recent publication. It came out on the 5th of August of this year.
Look at you grow.
I know. Yeah. Trying New to get book. Those, that approval rating up there. on NetGalley. But so it has an absolutely beautiful cover. So it does a kind of gorgeous, like, purpley background. I'm trying to find it here on my phone, and as usual with all the book pictures, I can't find it. Oh, here it is. So I'll zoom in.
Okay,
it's gorgeous.
Oh, that color is so rich.
It is such a striking cover. It's kind of more of an indigo blue background, but there is a tree growing up, and around the tree is the title. But it's kind of beautiful, kind of purpley hues. The tree is in kind of a yellowy orange. Oh, it's just so beautiful. So Elif Shafak is a very well-known author, and I was really excited. This is the first book I've read by her. So I was really looking forward to it and kind of went in with like no idea what it was going to be about.
They're the best books.
And I was then extremely shocked by how deep the book was. So this is an absolutely beautiful book, but it is heartbreaking. Like, there is just tragedy and loss and grief, as well as complete love and things like that. Oh, like, my heart was just breaking. So there are three narratives in the book. So we have Ada, who is a 16-year-old. We have kind of Kostas and Daphne kind of intermingled in the from the 1970s in Cyprus. Ada's in the 2010s in London. So we're kind of shifting time points as well. And then we, the strange choice of having a tree, a fig tree, as a narrator.
Oh, it's like Dead Papa Toothworth.
So it's I'm gonna say that I'm gonna come back to the tree as a choice because it's interesting and I have points to make about the tree.
Okay,
so with this book, I think the main thing that I went in not knowing was the history of Cyprus at all. In my mind, you know, we're very far away, and with a lot of things in countries, we don't learn the histories of other countries at all, unless it's like the French Revolution, the American Revolution, you know.
You learn the wealthy rule the world countries, and then you've got to do your own digging.
Yeah, you kind of learn the kind of more cultural significant points, but anything about a much smaller country, an island, we wouldn't hear about at all. Being an island ourselves,
this is like Americans who don't know that Northern Ireland and Ireland are different.
Exactly.
The same thing.
I learned an awful lot. So we're kind of seeing in the 1970s portions of this book, Kostas and Daphne are these kind of Romeo and Juliet of their time. They are star-crossed lovers, and Kostas is Greek and Christian, whereas Daphne is Turkish and Muslim.
That's so such a, I love the names.
Oh, they're beautiful names.
Yeah.
And there's a huge divide there. They are not supposed to be together at all. The island is pretty much divided between the two sides. And we can see as the book goes on that things are escalating quite a lot. There is more and more violence. There's more radical groups coming to the front, trying to take power. And it is so dangerous. And especially for the two of them to then try to be meeting up in secret. If they were caught, they would be killed. So it's kind of this kind of forbidden love, and it like their relationship together, like they absolutely adore each other. And it's just so kind of, I'd say Romeo and Juliet, but a lot more self-aware. You know, the way, I mean, Romeo is so fickle. Jesus, like, I would not have put it past him to be like, oh, Juliet's dead, off I go. Like, if, like, so, like, Kostas and Daphne, they are completely in love. And all around them is just complete violence and turmoil. So then kind of when we switch to the 2010 period, Kostas is, we find out Kostas and Daphne emigrated to London, or emigrated to London, and are now, they have had a daughter, Ada, and she's about 16. And I think the book opens with her narrative, and Daphne has been dead a year. She passed away.
Oh,
I know. I was like, after I read their love story and everything, as the book goes on, you're like, no, why?
Grief is the thing with feathers of it all.
So we can see that they are completely struggling with grief, our two characters. And with Ada, we find out very quickly that Daphne and Kostas made the decision when they moved to London to not share their history, or their country's history, really, with Ada. they wanted to shield her from the tragedies of their past. And that kind of, I kind of wish it was made a little bit more of, because we kind of see hints of how angry she is at them for not sharing things with her. Mm-hmm. And there's questions that she asks of like, why have I never met my family? She's never met either side of her family from her parents' side, because neither
and not knowing approved. Oh,
you know, we later find out that Daphne's parents forbid any contact with Daphne at all until, like, do you know? And I mean, it's heartbreaking to read that, and then to read that she views herself as a problem as well. They probably curse her name and they hate her, and she's only 16. Do you know?
I know. And there's gonna be like, if she's not given all the details, and if she's a little kid, she's gonna blame herself naturally.
Absolutely.
You're like, why don't they want to see me?
So, as well as on top of that, she's dealing with her mother's death. Mm. Do you know? And everything comes to a front. And when we actually meet her, she's in school and she's asked a question by the teacher, and she stands up to answer her, which I was like, okay, ew, who, schools that force you to stand up to respond to a teacher? No. But she has a kind of a break, and she starts screaming, and she can't stop screaming, and she can't sit down. And we kind of meet her instantly where she is at her, the edge for her. And she's unable to kind of talk to her dad. The relationship, we can kind of see, has really gone downhill. And he kind of skirts around her. He doesn't really want to talk about issues. And there's this kind of moody teenage aspect where she doesn't want to tell him either. Mm. So it's, you're there kind of going like, oh my God, someone come in and rescue them. And then comes in her aunt, Miriam. And she is Daphne's sister. Now, immediately, mm-hmm. Ada wants nothing to do with her. She's like, you didn't even come to my mother's funeral. And there's a lot of, I would be angry. I would be so angry.
Oh, no, you know, of course. Like,
she did send her letters and postcards to them. So she did stay in contact. But she said until her parents had passed away, she wasn't allowed to travel to see Daphne.
Oh,
so her coming to visit is kind of this huge moment for Ada. And she kind of gets we see a lot of cultural things, you know, superstitions, her beliefs, and, mm-hmm. you know, kind of old women's tales kind of coming into it. And it's lovely. It kind of, I think she helps bring Ada a little bit out of her shell. Like, I would have loved if there was more of that kind of going on through the book. We kind of leave them at a point where I wish they hadn't come as far as I wanted them to. Do you know, I just wanted a happy ending. I wanted to kick that wall down and just be like, off into the, you know, fields. There's, and like run around,
run and skip and joy.
Do you know, that's what I wanted. And I mean, yes, we can't get it in books. I mean, it's not realistic, but I was like, I just want this for these characters. They've been through too much. So as we're kind of jumping back in time a lot, and I mean, with Cyprus, I just never knew about this conflict that went on, and how we kind of see how this conflict and war really has devastated the people of Cyprus. We see the more long-term effects that this has had, because it brings us up to 2010, and we kind of go back into tracing missing people that have gone missing during the conflict. I mean, this kind of rings bells with Ireland, with people going missing up the north, do you know, and people never finding their loved ones or knowing what happened.
That's the scariest thing in the world.
It is. I could never imagine having to go through that in my life. And the amount of people on both sides of this conflict that have had to endure that in this book. And we see that some people, older or younger, don't want them doing this job. Daphne's is working as one of the archaeologists in digging up bones and trying to identify them. And she said, you know, they meet with a lot of hostility. Do you know, Andrew, they're
secrets
kind of going,
and
it's something that would be uncomfortable, obviously, but you're there kind of going, they're not, probably not going to prosecute. Let's be honest in these things. They literally just want to lay these people to rest and let their family know. Because it was coming up to a time when a lot of people from these families, like their partners, their wives, would have been at the age where they were passing away too. you know, and to go without that knowledge, I couldn't imagine having to do it. So it does kind of those longer consequences that I think a lot of people, they focus on the here and now, you know, like, oh yeah, that big war that happened. Okay. Yeah. Oh, it's over. They've stopped
back
fighting.
Back to the boom.
Do you know, they've stopped fighting and then you're left with the consequences when you're there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, and it's horrific. And I just really, those parts really can blow you away with how even Daphne and other islanders, as they refer to themselves later on in the book, rather than as like, I'm Turkish or I'm Greek, we see how they have had to deal with the trauma. Do you know, like Daphne goes for a drink with a colleague after, and at one point they're like, they start laughing hysterically, but it's actually from manic.
Yeah.
And it's manic. It's not a normal kind of thing. And it's purely from what they've had to go through. And it's some very powerful moments in the book like that, where it's written so well. And in this like beautiful lyrical prose that you're like, oh my God.
Love a bit of prose.
Do you know, it just stabs your heart at some points. So it's a powerful one, but I would say it can be not going in, not knowing what it was going to be like. I found it deeply upsetting, because you do get, there's some side characters along the way that you get really, you know, connected to, and then you're like, oh God, please, please don't be killed. Like, you know, and the thing is with conflict, you can't guarantee anybody's safety.
There's no,
you
know, such thing as fair.
There's no such thing as fair that we see in this. And even, I'll get into the fig tree. With the fig tree, we're kind of, as a narrator, I think it more presents the history, because it originally, this fig tree was one that it was growing up through this bar that Costas and Daphne used to go to quietly meet up. And the owners were in on it because they themselves were Turkish and Greek. And that couple, I loved them so much. And they were so beautiful. But this fig tree, the bar was later destroyed. And Costas went, before they were moving to London, he said, I'm going to get a cutting of this tree and bring it with us. So they had a piece of home with them.
Aww.
Now, Costas is big into nature anyway. So, I mean, this was like a huge thing for him. So when it comes to London, we're kind of seeing this kind of representation of the history of their relationship as well as the history of Cyprus. So it was very interesting. I mean, I've never read through the eyes of a tree before.
Read Lanny,
you know, and it was interesting. I would say there are moments that didn't work, but what did work was more when it talked about those relationships and kind of seeing it from more a very kind of omnipresent eye, rather
like
than
the fly on the wall or the fig tree in the bear.
But I mean, it kind of, we also got the a lot of this showing how the conflict has a much deeper impact than a bystander or anybody would really realize, because we kind of see how nature was affected as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was kind of an interesting one. And I mean, I think as the book got going, I think it got used to the tree and it did get better. I think what stops it is at the very start, where kind of she's really personifying the tree. And we learn that, you know, Costas is deeply in love with nature. Like, he is, he's kind of in that field anyway, and he's amazing at his job, like really into the ecosystem, all this kind of stuff. And the tree then tells us that they are in love with Costas in a romantic way. And I was like, okay, at that point, I was going to put the book down. I was like, no.
I haven't read it. I haven't read it, so no, I can't.
I was at the edge that I was like, Becca, is weird.
I think my trees love me back,
but in a platonic way, not like I'm the one for you. Like, that's the vibe we were getting from the fig tree, and I was like, this will never work. And I'm not the only one who's actually like, today I wrote my review weeks and weeks ago when I read it, and I kind of looked up reviews, and that was actually brought up by so many of them. It was like, what was going on with this? These just it was just unusual. And I think if they had lost that and kind of had the tree as more of this kind of wise, older soul, which I think it was supposed to represent, I would have enjoyed it a lot more. Just those opening passages was odd. So, I mean, with any book that kind of has much more kind of deep topic, it's I always find it harder to talk about. And I really hope I've done it justice.
Oh, it sounds because divine.
There was a lot of things in this book that I absolutely loved. I do think that maybe this is, I think, her 12th novel.
Oh my God.
I know. Well done her. I think there was points where there was just too much going on. And I will say, I think with how kind of focused we are on the conflict in Cyprus and kind of the after effects of it, kind of then talking about climate change, I was like, whoa, where is this coming from? Do you know, I was like, I do appreciate, oh, I love a good book talking about climate change. I'm all for climate change, like, save our planet. But I just felt it didn't suit this book,
and it was almost like a side kind of thrown in thing. I know, I kind of get that thing as well, where it's like you're doing this topic so much justice that now this is a bit of a throwaway,
you know. I was there like, no, I think the sole focus should be on this family, the effects of conflict, their relationships with one another, kind of being able to talk about your own trauma.
But with his obsession with nature, was that why it came in, or was it quite
a little bit? I mean, that's kind of, he's into that kind of work and things like that, and he's very kind of fighting climate change and things like that.
Yeah, which could even be like a worrying about still healing from the past and still about to be wounded by the future.
I know. So, I mean, it is an amazing book, and I did love so many passages in it. So I'd give it an 8 out of 10.
Nice.
But there were some things that I just wanted a little bit more, like even fleshed out, like Kostas actually kind of, that he can't talk about what he's gone through, and definitely couldn't either. And then how it affects Ada, and even her heritage, you know, just, oh, it is a very powerful book, and I did love it. I mean, I'm glad I went into it with kind of not knowing anything, because sometimes when you know it's going to be a heavy book, you're kind of like, oh.
Oh, I know, you're kind of reading it very tense.
Or you'll be like, I'll read that when I'm ready. And yeah, it was, I'd love to hear what other people think of it, because it is such a recent read. There's not many reviews up about it yet, even from critics and things like that. But I mean, I thought it was a very strong novel. Yes, the having a tree as a narrator is something to get used to. I think it does, it did work later on in the book, just that start, I'm not like,
I know, but I don't know, I really want to read this, because I did love the way it was done in Lani. I'd love to see your opinion on Lani, because I'm kind of basic, I'm going into this, like, listening to this review in the warm light that I think of as Lani, and I love the weirdness. And but I know it probably, like, I'd love to know how it carries in terms of how I found Lani carried for me. Add that to your list, Miss Becca. Short book. I think it's only 200 pages.
I mean, that's grand, because I mean,
oh, nice.
Got to get up to my Goodreads quota for the year.
Yeah, girl, do it. It's a good book.
But a little bit about Elif Shafak. So she is an award-winning British Turkish novelist and the most widely read female author in Turkey. So amazing woman.
Wow.
She writes in both Turkish and English and has published 17 books. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought this was her 12th. 11 of which are novels. Okay.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So her work has been translated into 50 languages. She holds a PhD in political science, and she has taught at various universities in Turkey, the US and the UK, including St. Anne's College, Oxford University.
Nice.
So she is a member of WEFRM Global Agenda Council on Creative Economy, and a founding member of the European Council on Foreign Relations. An advocate for women's rights, LGBT rights and freedom of speech, Shafak is an inspiring public speaker and twice a TED Global speaker, each time receiving a standing ovation. Shafak contributes to major publications around the world, and she has been awarded the title of Chevalier des Arts et des Lettres In 2017, she was chosen by Politico as one of the 12 people who would make the world a better place. She has judged numerous literary prizes as in, and is chairing the Wellcome Prize 2019. Wow.
Gorge. That's high praise.
That is, wow, that is
a, what a badass
biography.
I must read her. Now, this book, you know, I don't know how much you know about this book, because when we were at the milk market on Saturday together, I tried to and failed to bully Becca into buying this book, which is why I am now passive aggressively making her listen to me talk about it so that she will buy this book.
The reason I didn't get it, I was like, this, I like buying my books if it's secondhand. I love them to be in very good condition.
Yeah, it wasn't in great condition.
It was okay in condition. It was just a bit dirty. And I was like, you know, yeah,
my the OCD bougie bangs. It's bougie Becks.
So I am looking at Elifer Oliphant. Eleanor. Oh my God. Jesus. When it gets late, like
Elifer Oliphant.
Yeah. I was about to say Elephant Oliphant. I was like, oh, Jesus. So this is Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine by Gail Honeyman. And I have heard, the amount of times that Nikki has told me to read this.
Yeah. This countless. It's, you know, less for that I think you'd love it. I'm just baffled you haven't, because this book, like when we say Sally Rooney is everywhere and everyone's read it, like that weirded me out that you hadn't read Sally Rooney, but it was a bit more recent. But this book, everyone's read this book.
See, the reason is I did tell you why about Sally Rooney. That was because a friend told me not to.
Yes, but this one, I just don't understand how you bypass it.
I think it's a book that I always picked up and I was like, oh, I must get that next time.
But, yeah.
And then I get distracted by something else that I was like, oh, you know, I was immediately like, I want to read this. So, okay, I'll describe the book cover. So this is a beautiful kind of aqua background, and we have a girl crossing her arms. She looks, we can't see her face, we can see kind of from her chin downwards, but like from the hands crossed position, I'm like, she looks pissed. She's kind of got long brown hair, she's wearing a button-up kind of orangey t-shirt or orange shirt, green nail polish, which is an interesting choice with this outfit, and a brown skirt. So, yeah, okay.
You're not getting a whole lot. This is revenge.
I'm not getting a whole lot. So
last week, Rebecca gave me a book on the last episode.
Can we now start a counter with how many times Nikki hasn't given me a nice book to like guess? Because like, not calling you out, but I'm calling you out. Like,
well, I am giving you the main character's name, so I think I'm actually being very good.
I mean, that's actually probably kinder to me than actually giving me an easy kind of cover to guess.
Yeah,
because I don't like picking out names. As referenced from the last episode, even when I was given the name, I didn't like it.
We need to stop referencing it, Becca. The episode doesn't exist. People are going to be really angry. Well, no. They're probably not going to care that much, but look, you missed out on some good shit.
If we do say so ourselves. So, yes. Okay, I'm going to go by her outfit. This looks 70s to me.
Okay.
The hair, the outfit, it looks 70s. Now, the green nail polish kind of throws me a little bit. I don't like that. But it kind of looks it looks like it's kind of colored in with pencil or something like that, because it kind of looks like a suede effect on the clothes, and that's what's giving me the 70s vibe. So because only in my mind, only in the 70s would they wear a suede shirt and a suede skirt. So correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know much about fashion, to be honest, or fashion history, as my sister will attest to. So I'm okay. How to not make this about man bashing.
You heard it, folks. She's trying.
Trying. Oh, I haven't done it in a while, so let's go for it.
Let's man bash.
Let's man bash. So I'm going to say that Eleanor Oliphant is, I'm going to say that she's recently, she's 16. I'm going to say this is based in the UK. She's 16 and she just is completely bored of her life. her parents are like, okay, you're 16, you're a girl, no more school for you. And she's kind of this kind of character where she cares very deeply, but she doesn't want to show it. So to them, she's like, oh, F you, like, didn't want to go to school anyway. But like at night then she's like sobbing her eyes out.
Oh, soft baby girl. She's a cancer.
Deep down, she's upset.
Yeah, but, she's got a little hard shell and a squishy belly.
So her parents are like, her mom is working in a department store, I think part-time, like 3 days a week, because her dad is very chauvinistic and is like, she needs to be home to put my dinner on the table, do you know? Oh. And I want a nice clean house. Like, I don't want any muck from the lads.
Shut up.
Coming in. And she's kind of, I think this is kind of around the time where Eleanor never really questioned things before. Do you know, she was always like, oh, mom will do that, like, grand, blah, blah. And now she's expected to do the work. And she's like, hell no. Excuse me. Like,
this is a right
cup of tea, like. You know, and then I'm going to say she has two older brothers. She's a younger sister as well. So, like, she's kind of slightly kind of half of the middle child. So her two older brothers, like, one of them is still in school. The other brother, I'm going to say he's just started work or whatever. I'm going to say he's, like, 22. And the other brother's, like, 18. So already there's a bit of jealousy there that, like, one brother's still in education and then the other brother, I'm going to say, is taking complete advantage of her being at home. And it's like, what is it? Like, he's like, oh, iron my shirts, like.
Oh.
You know, and he's like, oh. Throws like,
and then, like, puts them on the floor.
Yeah, he's like, and then she's like, iron them. I have to wash them first. He's like, yeah, like, that's implied. Do you know, all this kind of crap that she has to, and then, like, if she has to bring him his lunch because she hasn't got a job yet. She has to bring him his lunch. And like, he like makes fun of her in front of all like his office pals or whatever. And it's just, oh, just horrible. And like, she's just angry. Like, she's so angry.
Right. So bitch.
Her mom, after a few weeks, her parents like, okay, you're going to have to start paying bed and board. Like, you're 16, like you're an adult to us. You have to go off and get a job. So her mom gets her an interview for the department store that she works in. And immediately, like, she turns up. She does not want to be there. She's wearing her mother's clothes. I'm going to say that is potentially, maybe not her mother's clothes. I don't think her mother would wear suede. But I think her mom, like,
dressed
very,
her.
Very housewife, kind of like, oh, yes, you know, like.
The way I dress.
No, you dress nice.
I dress like a housewife.
I'm gonna say, even if she was wearing like a pencil skirt, so maybe not housewife, more pencil skirt, white blouse, kind of very frilly.
Oh, like when you're 15 and you have to go for the like mock job interview in school, it's and you just bad. Wear the fucking worst clothes.
That's bad. And we can tell immediately, I'm gonna say this description in this book, my hypothetical book of this, is that like it is so ill-fitting. Like it Aww. Is just, I'm gonna say the skirt, you know, when it bags up, pencil skirts, Aww, like they need to be nice no. and tight. It's like bagging up and like the material is like so like, I'm gonna say it almost like crinkles when she walks. Like it's like and then the top is like, it's like it's loose on the shoulders, so like her collarbones keep popping out.
And there's shoulder pads, and the shoulder pads are get like.
Oh, the one shoulder pad is now a boob. Like it's just, it's bad. It is just horrific. So she turns up for this interview, and there's girls there that are like dolled up to the nines, like, and she's like, okay, all their clothes fit, and she's not wearing a scrap of makeup, even though her mother was like, oh, blue eyeshadow, like, whoa. She like scrubbed it off in the bathrooms. So she goes in for the interview and it's like three guys. And they're like, oh, we're head of the store. We're the manager of the store. And one of them's like, I'll be the manager of the department you'd be working for. And then the other guy's like, I'm whatever. Like, you're just like, okay, you're HR. All right. And she's like, they keep eyeing her up. She doesn't get invited to sit down. All these kind of creepy things. Like there's comments passed of like, oh, let's say, you know, a husband came in and, you know, what if he like said, oh, you've got pretty eyes and a nice smile, or like, oh, your
smile, you look prettier. When
yeah.
You
or he's
smile.
Like, oh, you're just as attractive as my daughter. And oh, if I was 20 years younger, you know, like, oh, I'd be waiting for you outside when you finish work. all these kind of scenarios. And she's
Becca,
like,
these came to mind too quickly.
I'm not going to lie, that comment about me being as attractive as their daughter, that was said to me in my first retail job.
That had to be said because that was too disturbing.
And it's a comment that completely shocked me. And I was very lucky that I had two very supportive guys working right beside me. And they were like, okay, we're taking over.
Creep. Oh, God.
So, yeah. But yes, that was a real life situation. But continue on with Eleanor Oliphant. She is, she literally tells them, I tell them to fuck off. And they are like, oh, my God. She is immediately like asked to leave. They're like, okay, that's all. Like,
and, get out of here.
When her mother comes home from her job, because her mother's been told about it, her mother screams her out of it.
Oh my God.
He's like, oh, we'll be kicking you out like if you can't find a job. And I'm going to say that she gets set up for like all these different interviews. It's like the receptionist for a hairdresser's, secretary for, you know, somebody, mm-hmm. a lawyer downtown, salesperson for the local chemist. All this, in every interview, she digs her heels in. She's like, I'm going to be the worst version of myself I could possibly be, because life, this isn't fair. Just because I'm a woman, I can't continue my education.
So yeah, no, she's not having it.
No. So I'm going to say there's one day that I'm going to say her bus doesn't turn up on time and she has to walk home. And I'm going to say like this is going to be like a 2.5 hour walk for her without the bus. And she hears chanting and she's like, oh my God. So she goes to try and discover what it is. And she finds out it's a women's youth rally. It's a women's rally.
Yes!
For women's rights.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And she's like, oh my God. And it's being held in one of the local universities or something like that. And she can see like the police are getting really riled up. And she's like, the women aren't doing anything illegal. And she's like, oh my God, these women are my idols. And it's something, it's kind of like the self-discovery for herself that she's mm-hmm. like, I really do care about this, do you know? And
like, I'm ready to, I want to do this.
Yeah. She's like, hell yeah. Like, this is something I should be standing up for. Like, this mm-hmm. is why, like, I, like, it's not fair. I don't get to finish my education. Bitch. And I'm going to say that she's just admiring from the sidelines and the police start arresting women. And she's like, okay, my time to leave. And she gets yanked. She gets yanked and they think she's one of the protesters as well. And she's so she's kind of just dragged along with it. And she's like, okay, like, so obviously her parents come and her dad and mum arrive. And I'm going to say that they bait her out, but they're like, you're not coming home. Like, they have packed a suitcase for her. They leave the suitcase down at the reception area of the station. Her dad like gives her like £10 and he's like, off you go.
Oh no.
And I'm gonna say that some of the other women from the protest see this and they're like, hey, she wasn't actually involved. Like, this was like, we've repeatedly made statements that like she shouldn't be in here, blah 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 mm-hmm. blah. They don't believe us. And the dad just turns around and goes, I don't believe you either. She's a troublemaker, like, she deserves this.
Oh my
this.
God.
So immediately, like, she is in floods of tears. And all of this course. Kind of I'm tough girl persona, like, completely crumbles away because...
Oh, sweet honey bear.
The people who should love her unconditionally... God, I'm making a lot more speech mistakes today than usual. It's later recording time, people. I'm going to say... The people who love her conditionally, who should love her unconditionally, don't. Mm-hmm. And she's like, they don't support me. And she, you know, so obviously these women all rally around her and they're like, oh my God, you poor thing. And I'm going to say this is a mixture of like, there's college students, but she's also noticing people around her mother's age that were involved mm-hmm. in this rally. And she's like, oh my God. So she's taken home by them and they're like, okay, you know, we're gonna give you like Patricia's bed. Patricia won't mind. And Patricia's like, oh, you're fine, blah blah. Mm-hmm. And she's just completely welcomed in by these women. And she's staying in college dorms for the moment. And they're like, obviously, we have to sneak you in. Like, we're not allowed.
Yeah.
And then she's taken to a meeting or whatever, and she, you know, she has the best time of her life kind of staying up all night chatting with these girls. And she's like, I've never felt more connected to people. You know, I, you know, she was like, girls in school, they didn't understand, like, they had no problem giving up their education to go and work, you know, and things like that. And she's like, oh, I had a problem with it. And so we kind of, she gets chatting, she's brought along to their next meeting because they're like, okay, we have literally had to hide her like under the mattress from people like inspecting our rooms. Like, they know she's in there, and like, we are going
to
get,
they're just trying to catch her out at this point.
One of the women from around her mother's age in the
girl group. This is what I mean, you have to write this. That's ridiculous. This is more detailed than my review.
I'm saying, when I see, my imagination just gets going, and then I'm like, oh yeah, fully flesh this out. So I'm going to say one of the women around her mom's age group at this meeting volunteered to let her in and stay in her house. Mm-hmm. And first night she's there, she's like, okay, I wouldn't mind having a chat if you come down for a cup of tea. And I'm going to say, I'm going to make her Irish and say she's an Irish immigrant. Yes. She is just a hardworking Irish mammy. And she's there like, your parents didn't even pack pajamas. Like, what? Your father obviously packed this case. So she goes off hunting for like one of her daughter's old pajamas. And she's deathly afraid of her. I'm going to say that like, Eleanor Oliphant is down and out Protestant, and she's like, oh my God, what the hell is this cross doing up here? The photo of baby Jesus. We're talking about 1970s Irish women. Like, there would have been crucifixes and Jesuses everywhere.
Would have been.
Wall to ceiling Jesuses. And I'm going to say that she sits down with her and she's like, okay, I'll tell you my life story if you tell me mine. She's like, your conditions in staying in this house is that you have to be completely honest with me. So anyway, we find out that this woman immigrated over with her husband to mm-hmm. find work. And she said her husband worked very hard and obviously was never taken seriously because he was Irish. And she said they had 5 wonderful kids and mm-hmm. all of them are grown up. She said my youngest is now off to college. And we've later find out like her kids are like geniuses. Like, one went to mm-hmm. Oxford, another went to Cambridge, like 2 are doing medicine. And she's like, I just wanted to be supportive of them. And, you know, so she's had kind of a pretty tough life of kind of looking after people. And she said her husband was the most supportive thing in the world. And he died of a heart attack in the last like 2 years. And she said what kind of inspired her to get involved in women's protests and things like that was that when she started trying to go out and find work, she was completely discriminated against. She didn't understand why she wasn't making out as much as the men. Mm-hmm. She like, as well, her age, they were like, we want you in the back, like, ew, and not out in the front, you know. And then she said the treatment of her daughters when they went off to college, so it was sickening. She was like, why can't they be a doctor? Like,
yeah.
She's like, oh, do you know? And I mean, she's already like, Eleanor is like, because we're kind of seeing this like hard shell of, she's like, I'm going to be a tough woman again. Like, mm-hmm. you try to mammy me around. Like, and immediately she's like, this woman is just, I'm going to say she's gas crack. And she's just an amazing woman. So Eleanor tells her what happened with her family. And this woman is like, if you want to go back to education, I will support you. And she's like, I will pay for it. So Eleanor actually ends up getting, like, I'm going to say, a Saturday job. She goes back and does her A-levels. I don't think there's any resolution with her family. I think she tries at one point. And I think she goes on and she goes off to college. And we kind of, the book ends with her kind of, that kind of journey of her starting college or whatever, with this amazing, like, female support behind her. So, yeah.
Becca, write this.
Apologies to all the males in our lives that are going to be like, Jesus Christ, she's back at it again.
Yeah, she's back at it again, boy.
And I'll be like, back again. Pow, pow, pow. Tell a friend. So yeah.
I love it. It's completely, like, it couldn't be more wrong, but I love it all the same. Her name is Eleanor Oliphant. Well done.
I'm very proud of myself for getting that right.
Yes. This is Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine by Gail Honeyman. I'm going to give a content warning, first of all, in this book for there's it deals with addiction. specifically alcoholism. Mm. There is a moment in the book where there are suicidal thoughts, and there's also a big overriding theme of trauma. But all the same, this book is a pleasure. This is a character who is going to succeed. So we are introduced to Eleanor Oliphant, and she is a finance clerk in an office. And the very opening line is kind of about how she works in an office, and like through the last like 9 or 10 years that she's told people she's worked in an office, no one's ever asked what kind of an office. So that's just her job. She works in an office, but she is a finance clerk. She is in her 30s, and she's actually only ever worked in this company. She's never left. She's been there since she graduated from college. And Eleanor is quite set in her ways and is a very lonely and quite isolated woman. And she's kind of making sure she stays that way because she has a really strict routine and a lot of rules that she doesn't really let herself break. So like her apartment, for example, the only people that have like ever come into the apartment are social workers and tradesmen, like the electrician to check the meter. No one's ever come on a social visit for her. She's had a very rough childhood, we start to learn early, and she doesn't really divulge into this at all. She has a scar from a childhood accident, and it's on the right side of her face, and she doesn't really go into how she got it. She'll only mention that it was the fire. And we don't hear about that for a long time in this book. And poor Eleanor is like exceptionally socially awkward, to the point like this is the unreliable narrator trope and the unlikable narrator trope done in such a cool direction, because she is really rude, like has no social skills, but it's because she's so naive and she doesn't even realize that people are taking to her badly. I just want to hug her from the beginning. I was like, I just really love you, even though you're horrible to the people around you. I'm sad for her. On the weekends, she has such a routine that she'll get the same frozen pizzas, the same vodka, and that's her weekend. Her weekend is spent by herself in her apartment. So where is this book going to take us now that we know Eleanor? Eleanor wins tickets to a local concert in an office raffle, and she immediately falls in love with the singer, a guy called Johnny Lomond. And before she's actually met him and like spoken to this man, Eleanor starts the preparations. She calls it the project. This is her future husband, and she has a lot of tasks she needs to get done so that he knows that he's met his soulmate when they lock eyes and they talk to each other.
Already, I'm just going to jump in here and be like, you don't have to change for any man. All right.
Well, Eleanor is going to do a lot of good growth along with the really materialistic, not needed growth. So Eleanor, it's like we realize how lonely she is by how twisted this whole, like she really believes that this is her soulmate, and like, I need to meet him and I have a lot of work to do now. And Eleanor's real supporter for this plan, this project, as she calls it, is her mummy, who she calls every evening. I think once a week, actually. I think she calls her once a week, and they call every week, and every time she calls, Eleanor's like, their conversations aren't helpful for Eleanor. She's belittled quite a lot, but she loves her mum, and mummy thinks it is a great project for Eleanor because it's the only way that her daughter will improve her life, because her mother thinks she is an embarrassing disappointment as of now. So she thinks it's a great idea for Eleanor to go and find her husband. So the project begins. Eleanor gives herself a full makeover. She books in to do her nails. She books in to do her hair. She starts getting fancy shoes and Marks and Spencers and is horrible to the sales assistant and doesn't really realize. And then my favorite scene in the whole book is she goes in to get a wax.
Oh, no.
And she's like, she's horrified.
Oh my God.
She's horrified, and they are horrified of her. Like, she walks in and having never touched the nether regions ever, and she walks in to get a wax, and they're like, what the fuck, like, we need a bushwhacker, like, and they're disgusted. She's disgusted afterwards. It's the funniest thing ever. She is just like, why do men like this? Why am I doing this? And it's very funny. So she's kind of, you know, setting, she's getting glam, she's doing her makeup more, she's starting to experiment with her eyeliner. She finally buys a smartphone and a laptop, and she gets Wi-Fi for the first time in her apartment. Oh, so that she can stalk his social media and get acquainted.
Okay, not good reasons behind it.
Then, as this is all happening, she starts to make a little bit of a friend in one of the new guys in the office, Raymond, who is the IT guy, and he's really nice and he's so sweet. And they're walking together one day, and he really likes her, but she does not like blinker visions on for this husband. She is absolutely not taken by him. And they're walking home one day, and he's being really lovely to her, and they see an older man collapse on the street ahead. And Raymond immediately, without hesitation, rushes to this man's aid. And Eleanor, for a minute, is like, what do I do? And they call an ambulance. The man's name is Sammy, and they save him. And they go to visit him in hospital. He's really grateful for what they've done for him, and he's a lovely guy. He introduces them to his kids because he just thinks they are the best people he's come across. And we meet Sammy's oldest daughter, Laura, very sophisticated and glamorous, and invites Eleanor and Raymond over to her house for parties and social gatherings. And all of a sudden, Eleanor has friends. And she's becoming closer to Raymond. She starts revealing details of her past, and we start to learn what made Eleanor the way she is as she sets up on this brilliant journey. And I love this book so much. This is a really, really, really just lovely book. The best part of this book are Eleanor, and the way this unreliable narrator thing is dealt with is just great. She's not dislikable to the reader. She's just very naive. Despite being a dick to everyone around her, you love her. And okay,
that's
so
a hard thing to pull off.
It is. It's, oh, I adore her. She's just, when I put the book away, I was just thinking of her. I feel like she's a friend of mine, and I want to text her and check in and see how she's doing, because she has a hard time of it. And like, she has no idea with how people perceive her, because she just has so much going on internally. She can't see past it. And this is a character that Gail built on someone who isn't a victim to their trauma, someone who's recovering from it, and what trauma can do to a person and how they can react, and the guards that they can put up. So to give you a little bit of info on Gail Honeyman, because I read a gorgeous interview on The Guardian with her, and she is just, oh, I love this book even more because of her. So they were talking about how Gail was led to write Eleanor Oliphant, and like, who this character is, where did she come from? And Gail said that she had read a newspaper article a couple of years earlier about like the growing rise and problem with loneliness in society in the UK. And at the time, it wasn't really something that she had heard of a lot of, outside of the typical thing we see with like, text your older relatives, look out for them, because they're the people that are very prone to isolation as you get older. But then, and it's obviously a horrible issue, but she then read an interview as she was reading into this article on loneliness from a woman in her 20s who confessed that when she leaves work on a Friday night, she often doesn't say anything until Monday morning. She doesn't see anyone for the weekend.
Oh my God.
And this is a quote from Gail. She said, "I started to think how that could be the case. And I realized there were lots of ways people could end up leading that sort of life through no fault of their own." And this book deals with loneliness. That's its main prerogative. And it's dealt with in a way that they're not the victim. They're the victim of bad circumstance. It's not their fault at all. And oftentimes it's not their fault at all. there's a moment in the book, and this was in the Guardian article as well, where Eleanor kind of reflects, and she never self-pities herself, but this is one of the moments when she does. And this is a quote from the book. It's, "These days, loneliness is the new cancer, a shameful and embarrassing thing brought upon yourself in some obscure way. It's a fearful, incurable thing, so horrifying that dare you not mention it, or so horrifying that you dare not mention it. Other people don't want to hear the word spoken aloud for fear that they might too be affiliated." And, or no, might too be afflicted. I can't read. Sorry. It's like nearly 9 p.m. on a Wednesday night.
You're like, nah.
I know. Oh, so this book, it's lovely. And Gail herself, with her story, she was meant to study a postgraduate degree at Oxford College after completing French. And she had another major as well. I can't remember what it was. But in her 20s, she realized in her master's that, like, the scholarly life is not for me. This is actually not what I want to do. And she dropped out of education. And she started working as a civil servant and kind of just led quite a normal, kind of peaceful life, and just got by and was happy out. But she always had a dream of becoming a writer. And on her 40th birthday, she finally just said, yeah, let's pursue it. And she joined a writing group. She started writing short stories. And just for the crack, she submitted a short story to a competition for an unpublished fiction run, and it didn't win, but one of the judges was a literary agent and picked up her book and said, like, yeah, this needs to be written. So she started writing the book after work every day on her lunch breaks, and was just kind of enjoying the life of being a writer, you know, having a nice time, but taking it very just, she's very lucky to do this. She'll see where it goes. And she, as they started sending it off to publishers, she wasn't thinking much of it. And she actually found out while she was abroad, like on holiday, that it was being picked up, and it was being fought over as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So she quit her job immediately as the editing process begins, and she has her publishing house, and she's got to make new edits to the copy. She loved that process as much as she did writing it, because that was kind of her dream. She always wanted to be a writer. And within days of this being published, this book was snapped up for a film by Reese Witherspoon. Reese Witherspoon has a media company that immediately bought the rights, like within days of this being released. It won, the main reason people know this book is because it won the Costa Book Award, and it's her first novel. She will be coming out with a new book soon. She's writing, and she says in her kind of retrospect for this book, that this book is really a love letter to Glasgow, the hometown she grew up in, that she left to go to college and came back to. So she wrote this book as a love letter to Glasgow, the town where she grew up, where she left and went to college elsewhere, and then she came back to. And there's, like, she said that, like, Eleanor's life in this book kind of starts to unwind and begin when that old man Sammy collapses on the street. And Gail Honeyman said that if that happened in Glasgow, 10 people would have come running to help him, because it's got a hard reputation for a city that has a massive heart deep down. And she said, it's a great city, and she owes a lot to it. So this book, I guess, a 9 out of 10, easily. Whoa. No hesitations about it. I don't know why it's not a 10. It's almost a 10. It's a 9. And I actually can't fault it, really. I think it just could be because I haven't read it in such a long time. But I still think about Eleanor, and I think about her going and getting a wax all the time. Like, it just makes me laugh so much. It's just, you'll keep this book with you after you've read it. You'll always remember it. I was in Charlie Burns in Galway a few weeks ago, and there was a girl looking for a copy, and she had 6 friends with her, and they were trying to get 6 copies because this girl was just like, this book is so good, like, you all have to get it. And they were going around the secondhand section trying to dig up like 6 copies of Eleanor Oliphant.
That's a lot to try and find in a secondhand shop.
So funny, you like, always howling. And then I was like, yeah, that makes sense. This is a great book.
I kind of regret not picking it up now.
Yeah, I
know. Do they have it on Saturday?
I have it on my shelf. If you need it, it is yours. My copy is just as distressed as the copy there, because mine fell in a puddle, and now it's kind of got the wavy edges, you know.
Oh,
and drowned. I don't know that cover. I have the white cover of this book, and I just have never seen a clean copy. I don't know what it is. It's the paint or something on it. I've never seen a clean copy in a bookshop. It's, I don't know what it is.
They come dirty.
They do. It's part of the charm.
Oh no, I love that. This I'm glad we book. Ended on a kind of a nice, happy note.
Yes.
But I think we're going to end it there, lads, because it's getting pretty late.
It is it's past our bedtime, Becca.
It is getting dark outside.
And editing Becca still must emerge from the shadows, and hopefully editing Nikki doesn't get called last minute, because editing Nikki can't do much. Nikki is really a last resort that doesn't work.
No, stop that. No, it'll be fine. This'll all be fine. This'll be out at midnight on Friday. It'll be good. It'll be fine.
It'll be great.
But
if it is, if you are listening to this episode on Friday, just give a big round of applause to editing Becca, and then go and donate to her fundraiser for the amazing Down Syndrome Limerick charity.
Do.
As she goes abseiling in a week.
2 weeks.
Or in 3 weeks. 26? No, 18.
Yeah, it's kind of less than 3 weeks away.
Yeah.
But with that, go follow us on Instagram, Goodreads, Storygraph, our own bookstas as well, Becca_the Grim Reader, Nikki_the Grim Reader, and Twitter, even though that's just never going to take off.
No, never.
And maybe someday we'll get to hear the last episode of Atlantis.
Hopefully it's in 2 weeks, and we get to take a little bit of a break.
The two of us being like, woo!
Week off! No, it's just going to be a week to
it's going to be a week more. Nikki's be like, week off, and be like, Nikki, turn up for recording right now. But with that, I hope you enjoyed, and until next time, bye!
Bye, bye. No, that's bad. Bye, bye.